iHeart Podcasts.
Guess what, Will?
What's that, Mango?
So, you know, I don't normally suffer from FOMO, but every once in a while I hear about a historic party I wasn't invited to.
I'm pretty sure you already told me about this. Is this the Gilda Radner party, right?
No, I mean, I do talk about that party a lot. And in fact, now that you've mentioned it, I am going to talk about it. There's this California party from the oral history of Saturday Night Live, and they discuss it. And it's basically every funny person in the world attended it.
It was pretty crazy to read about some of those original SNL cast members and some of the people that are just now such superstars. But you got Steve Martin there and Monty Python, the SCTV folks, like so many others that were all in this one place,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and during the night, somewhere along the way, they realized that Gilda Radner is really sick, and this is probably the last time anyone's going to see her. And when she tries to make her exit and say her goodbyes, Bill Murray just picks her up and uses her as this, like, improv prop and makes her laugh really, really hard. And then he passes her off to someone else, and they do that. And the entire night's just spent where people are just passing Gilda Radner around and using her as an improv prop and making her laugh. And it just sounds like the best party in the world.
But, yeah, it does.
That wasn't the party I was talking about. So this is way artsier, and it feels way more doable for us to get to. But in Berlin, this artist threw a same height party. And the whole idea was that he got everyone's height beforehand, and then he constructed all these slip-on platform shoes that were at the entrance. And before you could come in, you had to put on these giant blue foam shoes. And once you did, everyone who walked in the room was exactly the same height, 6'6".
Whoa, 6'6". So what's the point of this?
So really, it was just an experiment to see how your behavior changes. Like, you know how on TV talk shows, the host often has his chair jacked up super high, and that changes the dynamic? But the idea was, what if everyone is exactly eye to eye? What does it mean when we're all one height? And I kind of love the idea of how if you play with the settings, or, you know, you play with how you invite people, or even how you provoke controversy at a party, you can actually make for more meaningful and more memorable interactions. And that's exactly what our guest Priya Parker, author of the new book, The Art of Gathering, is here to talk about. Let's dive in.
Hey there, podcast listeners. Welcome to Part-Time Genius. I'm Will Pearson, and as always, I'm joined by my good friend Mangesh Shatikader. And sitting behind that soundproof glass, assembling a mixtape for his next house party. I hear these are pretty raging events. That's our friend and producer, Tristan McNeil.
Yeah, I took a peek at the tracks Tristan's pulling together. It's got everything from, like, Beethoven B-sides to Mahavishnu Orchestra to Spice Girls remixes. It's pretty eclectic.
Well, I got to be honest, I wouldn't expect anything less from Tristan. But, you know, today's show is more than just setting the mood with a soundtrack. We've got Priya Parker, author of the new book, The Art of Gathering, on the show. Now, if you've ever wondered what's the right size for a party, or how do you gently tell someone they're not invited to a gathering, or something even bigger, like how do you bring NFL players and owners together in a way that makes them both feel at ease and then has them leaving an experience feeling bonded? Priya has this amazing amount of experience and insight. So Priya Parker, welcome to Part-Time Genius.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we're fascinated by your background, you know, from the worlds you were bridging as a child to the events you organize and consult on now. And I was curious, before we get into all the conversation around gatherings, I was hoping you could just tell us a little bit about your background in conflict resolution, and then, of course, how you grew that background into starting Thrive Labs.
So I was born in Zimbabwe, perhaps uncommon place to be born. And I come from two different worlds. My mother is Indian, grew up in India, born and raised, and then immigrated to the U.S. for graduate school and met my white American father in Iowa, where he's from. And for about 13 years, they were married. They traveled the world together. My mother's a cultural anthropologist and my father's a hydrologist. And so I was born in Zimbabwe. And fast forward 9 years from my birth, and they separated. We were living in Virginia at the time, and both within a few years remarried. And I I'm an only child. I ended up basically traveling back and forth every 2 weeks between these two radically different households. My mother is Indian, remarried an English man. And that household was really a kind of very liberal, staunch Democrat, vegetarian, kind of Buddhist, Hindu, atheist household, and kind of all the accoutrements, new agey, as my husband likes to say. And my my father remarried, and he remarried a white American, Caucasian American woman, and they are evangelical Christians. And basically, I was part of both of these households. And my, you know, I think it deeply, deeply informs my work. And I basically realized that these two families gather differently. They use different, you know, code words. They use different language. And they have fundamentally, radically different views of the world. And yet I, as a biracial, you know, half Indian, half white American young woman, was considered by both families to be fully a part of their families. And so I guess it's no surprise I ended up in the field of conflict resolution. But I that early experience really shaped me to try to kind of be curious about and better understand why and how people come together and why and how people come apart.
That's pretty amazing. I do want to talk about how you find common ground in these conflicts and how you make gatherings interesting by having the spice of personalities there. But before all that, I just want to talk about gatherings. And I know you say it's important to know why you're gathering, even when it's something familiar like birthday parties or bridal showers. And would you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So, you know, I wrote this book, The Art of Gathering, How We Meet and Why It Matters. And one of the things that I found over and over again, whether I was doing research and interviewing, you know, Japanese tea ceremony masters or, you know, choreographers of circuses, basically anybody who creates group experiences for others, was the ones that kind of really took off and were transformative were the ones that were very, very, very clear on what their purpose was and what their purpose wasn't. And one of the things that I've seen, particularly in our kind of more personal private lives, is we often confuse categories of gathering for purpose. And so what I mean by that is, you know, a birthday party is actually not a purpose. I mean, we assume a birthday party is to celebrate a birthday, but that's what I would call a category. Or a wedding is to sort of get married. That's a functional category. And when we assume, you know, two people get engaged, they get very excited about having a wedding, at least most people do, or they dread it, or both. But one of the problems that happens in a lot of wedding planning is once you kind of start getting into the logistics, arguments about size, about style, about form, and often one of the reasons that a lot of conflict can happen, whether between the couple or between the couple and their kind of sets of parents, is because they actually have different ideas of what the wedding is for and who the wedding is for. And so whenever you're gathering, the first question to ask, particularly when you think that the reason is obvious, is to say, what is this wedding for? And for some people, the wedding is to honor their parents and first and foremost, and kind of at some level have a almost rite of passage for the parents to say, okay, we've done our job and our children are out in the world and they now are starting their families. And if that's the case, then if you are debating who should be on the guest list, you may want to choose, you know, your mother's colleagues over your long lost college buddy. In other cases, the purpose of the wedding might be to, you know, unite a tribe from very different sides of the world or to very different walks of life. And the couple may say, you know what, we want to have our larger community know each other and hold us through this, you know, marriage. And our wedding is an opportunity for all of the people who wouldn't normally show up to come together and for us to make sure that they really meet and have meaningful time together. And then you can talk about the guest lists or the food or, you know, the table setting or even the place. Because once you know what the purpose is, you no longer have all of these other proxy wars battling out.
Speaking of the invite list, one of the things you talk about or that you say is that when everyone is invited, no one is invited. And, you know, I'm curious, like, why is excluding people from gatherings so important? And And on that note, if you are going to be excluding people, how do you manage the feelings of the people that you exclude, or the Bobs, as you call them?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think one of the things that paradoxically kind of mess up, or at least dilute some of our gatherings, is this sort of age-old adage, the more the merrier. And that saying comes from a spirit of generosity, which I, you know, strongly recommend to have whenever you bring people together. but whenever one of the things that kind of happens in a number of different gatherings is that when we kind of invite anyone and everyone, it's hard to have people connect over something specific. So, for example, if you're having a birthday party and invite kind of everybody you know, or even if it's a small birthday party, but you invite people from all different parts of your life, it may be hard for people to kind of connect over, you know, they kind of have to figure out what they want to connect on and over. Whereas if you get more specific, so for example, okay, this year for my birthday, I want to really focus on reconnecting with my siblings, or I want to cut out the people in my life that are bringing out the parts of my life that I don't really want to be doing anymore. And I want to really focus on the people that are bringing out the best in me. It gives you a clear sense of who you actually want to invite and who you may not want to. A friend of mine was recently invited by his grandmother to for her birthday. He lives in the U.S., but his grandmother is in Germany. For him and his adult siblings to go to their grandmother's birthday. And the grandmother specifically said, no partners, no children. And this was an extremely controversial invitation. And the partners felt, you know, some partners didn't care, some partners kind of felt badly. Some of the, you know, adult grandchildren thought this was a very strange invitation. Others didn't think anything of it. But at the end of the day, they decided to go. They said, you know, it's grandma, she's getting old, she's in her 80s, like, it's kind of like a quirky, you know, quirky invitation, let's just go. And I spoke with my friend when he came back from this birthday party, which was basically time with his adult siblings and cousins. And he said it was one of the most beautiful times he'd ever spent with his siblings and cousins, because they met for the first time as adults without any of the other roles that they play in their life, you know, husband or wife, father. And so they were able to connect as adults for the first time in the way that they hadn't been able to since they were 13. And this kind of slow, beautiful, open time with their grandmother was this like gorgeous, meaningful time together that they wouldn't have been able to have, or would at least would have been different had they also been tending to their spouse's needs and their children's needs. And so it wasn't that they should do that necessarily every year, but it was actually the wisdom of the grandmother in exclusion and being willing to take some heat for it that allowed for some space for them to come out and kind of play as adults.
I love that. And I love that phrase you use, purpose as a bouncer, because it just feels really liberating, especially for someone like me who does tend to just want to invite everyone allow as many Bobs as possible to come. But I do have one question about magic numbers, and you talk about this a little bit. I'm always someone who never knows the right amount of pizza to order for things, and I like knowing that they're like specific numbers that are useful. Can you talk about like the certain types of gatherings and how many people you need to make those more effective?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm a facilitator. I work professionally with groups to create transformative experiences for them. And so groups of six tend to be great for great conversation when all six are, you know, actively participating. So whether it's a dinner or whether it's a support group. But the drawbacks of six is that if somebody isn't fully engaged, you know, you can't really bear dead weight. And it's also difficult if, again, depending on your purpose, to have a diversity of viewpoints. 8 to 12 is kind of a great number for small group experience where it's still lively and if well facilitated, everyone can talk. And above that, you know, 20, 30, that's a good size for kind of a buzzy party. People can still look around and over a few hours can meet, you know, everybody in the room or the majority of people, but it still feels kind of intimate, not overwhelming. And kind of works as a, you know, as an energetic gathering. You're probably not all sitting around the table, but you're milling around. And for weddings, you know, for my wedding, between 120 and 150, and you still feel like you're being held by kind of your community, but it's not so overwhelming that you have no idea who's there.
We have lots more questions for Priya, but first let's take a quick break. Welcome back to Part-Time Genius, and we're talking to author Priya Parker. You know, I'm curious, when you think about other meetings that maybe you're not organizing, I'm guessing it's pretty tough for you not to kind of post-mortem those events. You know, you think about recent gatherings that we see on TV, whether it's the White House Correspondents' Dinner or the way the NFL owners got together to talk about, you know, the players kneeling. Do you look at events like that and think about how they could have been executed more effectively?
Absolutely. And to me, that's actually, you know, one of the things I think is most interesting. And I think, you know, one thing that friends say to me after they've read this book is that the gift and the curse is you never look at a gathering the same way again. Mm-hmm. To take the two examples you mentioned, the NFL meeting, it had actually happened a while ago. It was recently leaked to the press, which is why it's in the news again. But last October, after Colin Kaepernick started this kneeling, you know, these kneeling moments and kind of this call to action to other NFL players to join, NFL owners and a number of players to come to their headquarters in New York to have a meeting about, you know, what they called the quote kneeling issue. And the tapes of that meeting was recently released, so you can listen to how the meeting kind of went down. And first of all, it was, I think, awesome that they fought to gather in that way. So I would say the first thing is that in a moment where there is multiple moments any time in a game where a player can choose to kneel and to activate a symbol that is extremely controversial in the public eye and means different things to different people, the idea for the owners to bring together the players and to actually talk about this is a great thing. So the first thing I'd say is whoever thought about doing that was on the right track. Mm-hmm. The second thing is, I think once they actually decided, and I haven't spoken to anyone from there, so this is all, you know, me speaking about it from afar. You know, one thing about a gathering is to think about how you seat people, where is the gathering. They decided to do it at the NFL headquarters. So on one hand, there's a lot of authority there and gravitas. On the other hand, it is at some level, the owner's turf. And they sat in a circle, as far as I understand, with the players and the owners sitting in every other chair to kind of show equality, which I would say is also good. But when you actually listen to the tapes of the conversation, they're broadly talking past each other. And what I would say is, you zoom back out, over and over again, the players keep coming back to the idea that Kaepernick is being blackballed from the league, kind of their language, not mine. And the owners basically are still trying to focus on damage control. And they're worrying that this sort of, as they call it, the kneeling issue is actually literally affecting their bottom line and is upsetting fans. And as you listen to the conversation, they're basically talking past each other. And what I would say is, going, if I was working with the organizers of that meeting, would be to step back ahead of time and say, what is the purpose of this meeting beyond kind of showing us, you know, symbolic camaraderie? What do you actually want to get out of this meeting? Do you want to come to an agreement? Do you want both sides to better understand where they're coming from? Do you want to focus on Kaepernick? Because that might seem, it seems like the players can't get over the idea precondition to actually talking about whether or not they're willing to kneel. Do you want to have the focus of the agenda be kneeling? And so basically, I think one of the problems with that meeting was that it wasn't clear what its purpose was. And then the structure of how they actually allowed people to talk, basically, it doesn't seem like there was a structure. And so it was a bit chaotic, and they just kept on talking in circles. And so when I look at a public gathering like that, one of the things that I look at is, how could they, if they have this incredible moment where they're bringing together players and owners for probably one of the first times in the league's history, how do you actually structure the gathering so that it meets its intended purpose? And what is the purpose for that gathering? You know, the place you host a gathering allows for all sorts of different options in how you gather. And it's not just logistical, you know, if you have a room that fits 20 people or a room that fits 150 people. But basically, anytime you're thinking about a gathering, you should have the place and the space work for how you want people to show up and what you want them to be thinking about. So let's just play with this NFL meeting for a second. They hosted it at the NFL headquarters. Imagine had they, as you said, held it in Selma. Imagine if they held it in Ferguson. Imagine if they held it in a stadium with fans in the seats watching, as long as they agreed not to speak. And they mic'd up the players and the owners and actually had a dialogue about what does this kneeling thing mean, and had the audience and NFL fans agree to listen but not boo or cheer. You know, imagine if they had it in an owner's home over dinner. Imagine if they had it at Colin Kaepernick's mother's home. Imagine if they had it at the Trump Hotel in Washington. Each of these choices should be very intentional choices. And by the way, will be interpreted by people in all sorts of different ways. I could see fans being very angry that a meeting like that would be held in Selma or in Montgomery, mm-hmm. or in any places that have symbolic, meaning. But all of that to say is the same thing is true for, a birthday party or a book event or a sales meeting. And one of the ways to really think boldly about the way you gather is to think about having your place really work for you. So if you are having, I know a publisher that had a book event in a cemetery. And already, no matter what they do in the cemetery, they've already transformed people's relationship to the book and to the author and to how they remember that event. And so one of the things to think about as you're gathering is where and how and what kind of strange venues might you want to gather in.
You think about what you were saying about the NFL thing. Like, if they'd picked a venue like Selma, or the owners and the players had walked across a bridge together, or,
totally.
that you could have really established a very different feel for this meeting, and how interesting that could have been. You talk about a scene in the book where there are these four important leaders that are attending a dinner event the night before a meeting, and there's this fifth really important world leader who wants to attend it but doesn't want to go to the dinner, just wants to go to the meeting the next day. I was curious, like, how do you convince self-important people, or even people who are gathering an event but are shy, to fully participate and buy into sort of the cadence of a meeting and the various events that are orchestrated or planned for a reason?
I mean, so it's a great question. And what you're kind of talking about at some level is the larger question of legitimacy. So in the example in the book, we had a meeting on a Wednesday, let's say, and it was a meeting where it was important that the leaders that were coming together basically interacted in a way that they wouldn't normally otherwise, and started to come with a spirit of openness. And so one of the things that I did was had a dinner the night before that was more like a dinner party, or even like a wedding party, than a kind of a work meeting. There's candles and wine and like stories and structure. And there was a state leader who couldn't make the dinner the night before, or didn't want to, or wasn't willing to kind of come. And at some level, one of the things that you are grappling with when you're designing an experience for other people is communicating with them, one, that it's important, but two, whether or not your event kind of has legitimacy. And what I mean by that is whether or not people are buying into your vision of what this is for, and whether they need to be there or not. That anytime, two or more people come together, decisions need to be made often over the course of any type of gathering. And basically, who's in charge and who needs, if there's conflict, how do you actually deal with it? And so at some level, depending on the context, so in an organization, if you're doing a gathering and there's a dinner the night before, in part because people have signed contracts and the authority lies with the, with the boss, you can actually require people to show up to a dinner. And by the way, that shouldn't be used lightly. So I often say, when I'm working with companies and they say we can require people to attend the night before, I often say, please don't require them. I want them to come of their own volition, because people behave very differently if they're required to be somewhere versus if they decide that they want to go. And similarly, with a wedding or with a kind of social gathering, to me, if people aren't coming to whatever it is you planned, I always say, like, pick up the phone and call them, if this is something that's important to you, and explain to them, what it is and why you'd love for them to be there. Text, email, Instagram, everybody's online, but I rarely hear anybody's voice anymore. And actually just making a phone call goes a long way.
You know, Priya, I was amused by the list that you put together of the 15 ways to make conferences suck less. And because, you know, Mango and I have been to so many conferences over the years and so many terrible conferences over the years. And, you know, I don't envy those that have to put them together because it does seem like a really difficult thing to put together a good conference. And so when you go to a great one, it's really that much more impressive. And I'm curious if you could share just a few of your favorite ideas for how to put together this type of productive gathering.
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. And, you know, there are conferences are on the rise and more people, more and more companies are starting to have, you know, conference wings and conference arms. Media companies are starting to have live events. So this is something that I think we're going to see more and more of. So it's a really important question. I would just say kind of simply the two principles that I think make conferences fantastic are intimacy and heat. And what I mean by that, one on the intimacy side, you know, there's all these studies that show that that people kind of connect much more when you share your vulnerability and things that, you know, aren't working as well. Brené Brown and sociologists like her have popularized these ideas about intimacy, often between two people. And I would just take that principle and apply it to groups and to larger gatherings. So a couple of things under intimacy. The first is to have people share in small groups or in large things that aren't working rather than things that are. So one of the things that I talk about in the book is, you know, rather than training everybody to kind of give their 2-minute stump speech and all of, you know, like how great you are, what you're doing, how, what kind of clients that you serving or, you know, whatever it is that you're doing in your company, to flip it around and give a sprout speech, which basically is sharing all of the things in your work that you actually are still curious about, that you don't know the answers to, that you're trying to figure out. And people are much more interested in kind of wanting to know what's not going well and how they may actually help. One of the groups that does this well that I've come across is the House of Genius, and I write about it in the book. They have gatherings all over the world where they invite 10 or 12 people to come together to constitute what they call a house, and invite 2 or 3 entrepreneurs to come in and get 45 minutes each to talk about what's not working in their business or what they need help with. And then those 12 people give them all sorts of advice and ideas. It's a very structured process. But basically, it ends up being, you know, a really interesting evening because implicitly you're saying, I need help. And we tend to want to help each other. The second thing is to do dinners where people share stories and experiences from their life that demonstrates some kind of struggle or some kind of, confusion. Because we, at the end of the day, want to connect with each other in meaningful ways. And so I think conferences that allow both space but also structure for people to share what's actually going on in their life, to me, are much more interesting. And then the second part is heat. And what I mean by that, coming as a conflict resolution facilitator, is anything that kind of gets people's temperature, rising in the room. It can be things that are controversial, but controversial that still serve the purpose. So controversial for just kind of controversy's sake isn't particularly interesting. But controversial when it kind of taps the core values of a community can be extremely invigorating. We tend to avoid the things that we think might, ruffle some feathers. And actually, from a perspective of a gathering, those are the ones that actually, people want to stay in the room for. So if it's a church gathering, one of the people I interviewed for the book was a secretary of the Society of Friends, basically Quaker communities. And she said some of the best meetings that they'd had, this is the Philadelphia community, Circle of Friends, Society of Friends, was when they began to consciously have meetings around whether or not to allow gay marriage to acknowledge gay marriage in their communities. And rather than avoiding it, they actually structured meetings around it and debates in the Quaker format, which is if you're moved to speak. And that, people come alive when they're talking about and struggling with and listening to one another about the things that most define them as a community.
And I'm curious, too, about the openings of conferences. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think openings are extraordinarily important. And one of the things that conferences can do is in the first few moments, in any type of gathering, people are walking in and wondering, you know, what's going on here? Do I want to be here? What part of myself do I show? Can I be jokey or should I be more formal? And we as organizers often vastly underestimate the importance of kind of setting the tone and creating a environment where people have permission to go up to each other and find ways to kind of go in. And so one of the ways of a conference that I love that I spoke to for this book is it's called Spark Camp, and it was started by five friends in the media industry. And one of the things they do early on, their weekend gatherings, they're capped to 70 people, so it maintains an intimacy but still a buzz. The first night of the gathering, so I guess Friday night, they do introductions, you know, as many conferences do, though less than you would think. But the way they do introductions is they take the weight off the guests for having to introduce themselves and either be, you know, stuck in their humble brags or, you know, all of the awkward ways one wants to introduce oneself. And the conference organizers give the conference what I think is such a gift, which is they spend time ahead of time researching every single one of their 70 guests, who often they don't know themselves, and come up with these short, whimsical introductions. And they gather together in a room and they actually read aloud each person's introduction without naming them. And they say, when you hear yourself, Stan. And so they may say, you know, this person met their husband at a beekeeping convention, and they are also one of the foremost minds on artificial intelligence. They grew up in Alaska, but actually because their parents were part of the Air Force, they lived in 12 states before the age of 16. And what happens is, you know, our eyes are kind of darting around trying to figure out who it is. But also, you're not sure if there's somebody else in the group that met their husband at a beekeeping conference.
Yeah.
You know, and so sometimes, you know, two or three people stand up and then everyone laughs and they have to kind of keep listening. And it's this brilliant exercise where it's interesting. Everybody is engaged because you don't want to miss your own introduction, but everybody's also engaged because they're giving you seeds of information that you can then go up to each of the other 69 people in the room over the course of the weekend and have three or four different ways into conversation with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they think very beautifully about how do you early on give non-awkward or at least less awkward ways for people to approach one another in meaningful ways about their work and also about things that have nothing to do with their work.
More questions for Priya after a quick break.
I love the idea, too, of you sitting out and charting out heat maps, which you talk about in the book, and to orchestrate some of the heat. But I'm also curious about these two interesting events that you've pulled together. One is 15 toasts and then these I'm here days. And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So 15 toasts came from this experience of going to events and having kind of amazing people in the room, but feeling that the kind of modus operandi was showing off or talking about how great everything was. And specifically, I was at the World Economic Forum, one of their annual meetings in Abu Dhabi, and a colleague and I, Tim Lebrecht, who were serving on the same council, realized that in all of these meetings, even though we're supposed to be talking about new models of leadership or values-based leadership, it tends to remain very heady, and, you know, or is an opportunity for people to kind of promote their company's latest initiative. And so we decided to run an experiment where the night before we gathered 15 people from a number of the different councils and invited them to come together over dinner off the record, though we all agreed we could share what happened at the dinner, but not attribute it to a specific person. So Chatham House rules. And 15 Toasts basically was this experiment that we kind of made up along with my husband, where everybody is asked to give a toast some point in the evening to a theme. And you choose the theme. The first one we ever did was, what is a good life? Not as what is the good life, but what makes for a good life? But you can choose a theme that the group would be interested in. It could be rebellion. It could be borders. It could be what does it mean to be American? It could be anything. And over the course of the night, people, you know, clink their glass, old school style, stand up and share a story or an experience from their life that relates to the theme. And the only other rule is that the last person has to sing their toast. And what that does is it kind of speeds along the toast, because basically most people, at least in the U.S. context, don't want to sing. And so it's this kind of playful way to get people to take a smaller risk, which is giving their toast. And what happens over the course of the night is you hear stories that are still along a kind of organizing principle that people would never kind of share in a context like that. But when you hear about somebody, falling in love for the first time or experiencing heartbreak, or I remember one story that was shared in a dinner that where the theme was strangers, somebody shared that their mother's life was saved because a stranger happened to be walking past her. Their mother fainted, hit their head on the ground, started bleeding. A stranger happened to walk past them in the same moment, called the police and saved their life. And because of that, the person sitting at the table like existed, was born. There's so much more after this dinner that you could go and talk to this person about than if she simply told you that she was the VP of sales at, such and such company. And so what 15 Toasts does, and you could use any format, but it allows people to share stories and experiences that are kind of, off the perhaps theme of the conference or kind of selling something, but basically makes them complicated and human. And most people want to talk to other people who are complicated and human, because that's what each of us are.
The book is called The Art of Gathering, How We Meet and Why It Matters. And it's available this week. But Priya, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks again for listening. Part-Time Genius is a production of How Stuff Works and wouldn't be possible without several brilliant people who do the important things we couldn't even begin to understand.
Tristan McNeil does the editing thing.
Noel Brown made the theme song and does the mixy-mixy sound thing.
Jerry Rowland does the exec producer thing.
Gabe Luzier is our lead researcher with support from the research army, including Austin Thompson, Nolan Brown, and Lucas Adams.
And Eves Jeffcoat gets the show to your ears. Good job, Eves.
If you like what you heard, we hope you'll subscribe. And if you really, really like what you've heard, maybe you could leave a good review for us.
Did we forget Jason?
Jason who?